distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, the graduating class and the audience in general. Not long ago, I read a very fine novel by Marcus Goodrich called Delilah, the story of a destroyer at sea in the Philippine Islands just on the eve of the last war. The thing I found the whole book very moving and interesting, but the thing that moved me most in the book was a short incidental section on the defense of the Alamo. Now, I suppose that the subject of the Alamo is a fairly hectic one to Texans by now, but I am sure it is not one which they do not respond in their private hearts, at least, with the feeling that it's a very proud thing to be a Texan. I can imagine that heroic defense of plain men on the American frontier 2,500 years from now, nerving the heart and arm of Texans as surely as the memory of Marathon and Thermopylae has lately nerved the heart and arm of the unhappy Greeks in heroic defense of their homeland. But I do not speak of the Alamo merely to pay tribute to Texas and Texans, but to emphasize, of course, that it is the primary tradition of Texas. And so is, in some ultimate sense, also the tradition of the whole South. The people who settled Texas came from all the states in the Union, of course, as it existed at that time. They also came from many foreign lands, and I have no desire at all to detract from the credit of any of them. But ultimately, Texans were mainly drawn from the stock of the older southern states. And the tradition of Texas is therefore the tradition of the older South. It's a tradition that was already formed and was different from the prevailing American tradition in a great many respects at the time these people began to arrive in Texas. I emphasize tradition here because tradition is very important in the world in which we live at present. The world in which the class of 1941 will be going forth. Totalitarianism is apparently sweeping over the world. It certainly swept over Europe. At the present, threatening the United States. Well, there are people who tell you that it's an irresistible way, men and women in the United States, who say that the only rational thing for us to do is to give up quietly. We're seeing the decay and death of an order of civilization. Well, for my part, I shall not believe that till I see it proved. I shall remember the history of the Alamo and of my country and believe that it will survive. When that is said, however, it's necessary to fix in mind very firmly that the world in which we are going is certainly going to be a very different one from the world in which we have known in the recent past. The world in which the class of 1941 will live, which will shape its lives and destinies, and also the life and destiny of the United States, of the South, and of Texas. That being the case, and since tradition is everywhere under attack, since the whole tradition of the Western world is under attack, and our tradition in the South, of course, is ultimately just a part of that tradition of the Western world, and I think it's very necessary that we should try to not only to approach the problems of the times that have come in with goodwill, but also as intelligent as possible in understanding of what our tradition is. Now, as I say, the whole tradition of the Western world is actually involved. Well, the limitations of time don't allow me to go into all that here this evening. What I am concerned with is the tradition of the South, with Texas bound into that tradition as an integral part of it. Well, what then is our Southern tradition? The best way to answer that, I believe, is to remember who we were and are, what we were in our origin. The answer to that is that we were a plain people in general, in our origin. John Wright used to like to talk about the poor, proud homes of England. Well, if you had the poor, proud homes of Scotland and Ireland and France, Germany perhaps, Spain now and then, why, you probably have just about where most of us came from. With the tradition of the Southern aristocrats. We've all heard of them all our lives, and a great many of us, even now and then, claim to be descended from them. Well, who were they? The answer is that we've created, to a certain extent, our own aristocrats. The people in Virginia and lower South Carolina, people around New Orleans, up the Mississippi Valley to some extent, were there a long while before the mass of immigrants got into this country. And they had time enough, some of them, to grow into aristocrats. So to start with, they were undoubtedly mainly simple people of the same sort as to us of us. The greatest planter in Norfolk, for example, the Norfolk area, was Adam Thorogood, and he came into the colony as an indentured servant. Another one of the famous family up there, which I need not name here, the founder of the family paid his passage across the sea as a ship's carpenter. Well, I instance these cases merely by way of insisting on the primary simplicity of our origin. A few of the people who came to this country, of course, actually did belong to families of considerable rank in England, in Scotland, in Ireland, anyhow in Europe. But that was the exception and not the rule. That still leaves the question of how the notion of aristocracy got so widely established in the South. In part, I think it's explained by the rapid acquisition of land and slaves by a great many people who had been poor and plain up until after the invention of the cotton gin. The plantation system, of course, was carried over the South by cotton. And the growing of cotton became profitable on a wide scale only after the invention of gin. Well, these people who had acquired the land and slaves naturally imitated the wealthier people of Virginia and South Carolina, in particular, sometimes the Louisiana, New Orleans. But there's more to it than that, I think. We come to what seems to me to be one of the most important things to understand about the South. That it has been, from the invention of, from the beginning of the fight over slavery, a society on the defensive. It was on the defensive because it had a guilt complex about slavery. The South was settled not only by Christian people, but mainly by Protestants, and they broke over with them the great slavery, which is always the thing of Calvinism. In the early days of the abolition movement, the anti-slavery cause actually won more support in the South than it did anywhere else in the American colonies, the American nation. But the South had a self-interest in slavery and didn't want to give it up. Now, you notice I say that the South had a self-interest in slavery, and not merely the slave owner. The introduction of Negro slavery over the South generally had brought in the notion of racial superiority. And though slavery involves a great deal of hardship, economic hardship and disadvantage for white people who did not own slaves, it was always pretty well balanced out by that feeling of racial superiority, plus a more or less conscious perception of the danger of competition, economic competition, which the Negro, if he were freed, would bring on. A book like Hinton Helper's Impending Crisis in the South, written in 1866, I believe, or 67, defined that the masses of white men were quite often even more determined not to let the Negro escape from slavery than the plantation owners of slavery. That brings us back to aristocracy. You see, for the South to paint itself as an aristocratic society was to say that it was a superior society. And it set up this doctrine that it was an aristocratic society, undoubtedly, as an answer to the Yankees, the North's moral superiority over slavery. So we have in the Old South a society arising from originally clean, proud, poor people, the growth of the plantation, and particularly the cotton planters. Some of them, by the time of the Civil War, were genuinely aristocrats. Others were on their way to being such. But the great majority, even of the ruling order, were not aristocrats. Yet the claim to such rank was virtually coexistent with ruling order, and often reached down below them. Because the Old South was, in the last analysis, a society which stood on the defensive. Torn between two powerful impulses, moral disapproval of slavery, on the one hand, and powerful self-interest, economic self-interest, on the other, the South had begun to retreat into unreality, to romanticize and sentimentalize it. And its peculiar institutions. That tendency to unreality, to romanticism and sentimentality, was its most striking trait, I think. It extended through the whole of Southern life and impressed every part, including that of religion and morality. By the time the Civil War came on, the best brains of the South would be occupying themselves with such futile projects as trying to prove by the Bible that God had ordained the Negro to be the slave of the white man. And while the ruling, Southern moral code was that of Puritanism, the conduct of many of those who professed that code was often anything else but Puritanism. Mind you, I'm not accusing the Old South of hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is a coolly calculated, conscious thing. And the South was not consciously engaged in double dealing. Merely it was responding to a situation which it found impossible to face, precisely as any other people would have responded to, by retreating towards unreality. But of course the Old South had other qualities besides this one I name of unreality, the tendency to romanticism and sentimentality. Many of them cannot be mentioned here because of the limitations of time. But one of them deserves special notice. I mean the characteristic of extreme individualism. This quality has extremely deep roots. The effect of the survival of the tradition of the frontier is obvious, and I shall not labor it here. But it also has to be noted that most southern white men retain some sort of land. Now, the best lands were absorbed naturally by the plantation. But lands that were good for the growing of corn for food and for a little cotton for clothing was pretty well universally possessed by southern white men. That's to say, of course, that they retained their independence. And independence is naturally the soil in which you get extreme individualism. Well, with that background, we come to the great disaster of the Civil War and Reconstruction. The march of the Old South towards an aristocracy was ended, towards a plantation aristocracy was ended. So was slavery. But for the old proud, sore defensiveness and attitude which we had had before the war, we now had added. We now had a much more developed sort of thing. The sensitiveness of a defeated people. If slavery was gone, and the North, well-meaning and not so well-meaning men, were demanding that the Negro should suddenly acquire not only equal rights with white men, but often even superior rights. If that the South responded as any other people would have responded, given the same tradition and the same environment. Often our response was violent and brutal. And so much was to be expected from them, from men with a long tradition of the frontier behind them. The South had always been violent. It was violent before the Civil War. Lincoln and the Duo were both flourishers as far as nowhere else in America. But let us understand, in saying that, that we're simply trying to understand something, not to pass moral judgment. Faced with the same problem, given the same environment and background, the North responded very much as we did in the South. But violence, of course, is incidental. What I want to emphasize most is that the South's tendency to reality, to unreality, to romanticism, to sentimentality, was enormously enforced by the Civil War and Reconstruction. If the movement towards the plantation aristocracy was ended, if even the people who had already achieved aristocracy were more or less being extinguished, yet in this period, the South would assert the notion of aristocracy in the Old South with far greater vigor than ever before. Again, as an obvious defense mechanism against the Yankees. The idealization and sentimentalization of the past is, of course, a normal enough thing for defeated people. And so is fierce defensiveness in general. Ireland is a good example. And our southern literature, the Thomas Nelson Page era, the Marsh Chans and Squires and Hams, has its parallel in the literature of any of those nations which have been defeated. Ireland, the poem, name them as you please. In itself, the idealization of the Old South as a country full of dueling gentlemen and ladies and farthingales might not be important. What is important is the tendency to unreality, which is summed up in this attitude, extended to all fields of thought. The greatest consequence. Patriotism to the idea of the South had always been an integral part of Southern defenses. Probably it had more to do with the South's pugnacity before the Yankee than slavery itself. The result of that was that before long, these people who had always had land before the Civil War, who had had their independence, found themselves being sold out and reduced to the status of sharecroppers and white tenants in order to make a living. So it's on the terms that were available, and those terms were fixed by the Negroes Company. But not even the white man's status of white tenant and sharecropper made him safe from the competition of the Negro. The numbers were so great till it soon became apparent that we were going to have open conflict. And that is fundamentally the reason that the South turned to industrialism. I say that this is fundamentally the reason. I understand, of course, that the desire of the early entrepreneurs for profit played a very great part in the industrialization, the rise of industrialization in the South in the 1880s to 1900 and afterwards. But there certainly was also this patriotic motive of providing a sanctuary for the masses of white men. The organization of new cotton mill factories of any sort in the South in those early years was often a communal project. In fact, it was late as the war period and the early 1920s. That was still true to some extent. And the man who built the cotton mill, who organized it and led the enterprise, was looked upon as very definitely a community benefactor. And he was, of course. He felt that himself, and the people granted him that it was a great public benefactor. But as time went on, it was no longer necessary to make the sacrifices which had been made in the beginning. Low wages and long hours, child labor probably, were necessary, at least semi-necessary conditions for the early growth of industrialism in the South, because it had little capital, and the extent to which northern capital was willing to aid has been greatly exaggerated. It had possibly to lift itself by its own bootstraps, and to do that, for one thing, they made very cheap products also. To make enough profit on the processing of cheap cotton goods, it was necessary to have low wages, long hours, and so on. But time passed and it was no longer so necessary. But this attitude, you see, that old unreality is. The desire to believe what you'd like to believe, coming back in that. The man who built a cotton mill still thought himself to be a public benefactor, whether or not he was actually doing anything but pursuing his own personal ends. And the attitude of the people remained. That is the explanation, I think, of the enormous hostility that has been shown in the South towards the labor union idea. It was somehow an attack on what we call progress, and so an attack against the integrity of the South's right to defend itself in the world. And this has been deliberately critical to me. I haven't tried to cover the whole history of the development of the South. You can't do that in one volume, as I found out. It would take a dozen. But what I have tried to do is to suggest some of the main lines of our development and some of the things that it seems to me are most important for us to know, to take into account. This is a very great rich land, this southern country of ours. Texas alone, I believe, has greater resources than all of Europe. Certainly the South is the richest comparable area in the world. Yet, we face now the need for renewed sacrifices. As the country moves into the National Defense Program, and we prepare to try to resist totalitarianism, we're going to have to make up our minds to the hardships. But I see no reason at all why we should make up our minds to more hardships, to more sacrifices than are necessary in the circumstances. And it's for that reason that I made this critical speech in which I point out what seemed to me to be a device of unreality and of romanticism, excessive romanticism, and excessive sentimentality. I have no desire to attempt to stamp sentiment out of the world. We've had too much of that recently in Europe. But sentimentality is a false sentiment which exists for the purpose of hiding something, for dodging something. And it is a very dangerous vice in the South now. Now, as far as individualism goes, why, it can be a great virtue. Just as the pride that goes with it can be a great virtue. But it can also be very dangerous if it isn't kept in check by the realization that man, after all, is a social creature. And that none of us has the right to stand outside the social organism. Thank you.